back to Shattering Myths. We're speaking about an individual who, after 55 years of being a leader in his Christian church, being a teacher in a Christian church, began to question his religion and began to realize that it was false, and has subsequently come to know Yahweh and come to find his Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and particularly his covenant, reassuring, enlightening, uplifting, true. And so the question becomes, how do we go about helping others come to know what we have learned? And I'm convinced that answer is twofold. The one is that until we can get people be willing to question that which they have clung to, no matter how prepared we are, it's not going to make any difference. That's why the first hour, and sometimes two, of this program is devoted to exposing the flaws in politics and religion and militarism and in economics. Because it's essential that we recognize that we ought not be dependent on these things, that we ought not praise these things, that we ought not ally ourselves with these things, that we ought not trust these things, that we ought to question them and distance ourselves from them. And that is an absolutely essential first step. When Yahweh is predicting circa 600 BCE, 2,600 years ago, that there would be a man named Shaul, that's Saul, Paul, who egotistically and presumptuously would corrupt his testimony to lead millions astray, particularly Gentiles, according to Yahweh. Yahweh not only calls him the plague of death, but asks us this important question. Why don't you question him? If you question him, you'll realize that he's lying. He not only contradicts himself, he contradicts Yahusha, he contradicts Yahweh. He claims to speak for the God that he consistently undermines and demeans, contradicting him. And so if you question him, you will question Christianity, because he's the founder of the Christian religion. And you'll leave it. And when you're willing to walk away from it, as Abraham was willing to walk away from Babylon, which is what God presents as a synonym for religion and politics and military and economic corruption, that once you're willing to walk away from that, then you're in a position to listen to what God has to say and to come to understand what he's offering. But not until that time. So the first thing that I would encourage those like Bill to do are to read Questioning Paul. And I'll blessyahweh.com is a great site. YHWH-QRA.com, another great site to get the latest version of Questioning Paul. Read it. So that you're armed with all of the ammunition that you could possibly need to get Christians who are open to questioning their religion to do so. But it's one thing to recognize that patriotism is misplaced, that politics is a game for fools, for the egotistical, and that religion is false. It's one thing to recognize those things. It's another thing entirely to come to know Yahweh, to understand what he's offering. So the second thing that I encourage is to read either introductiontogod.org or yadaya.com. And the reason I say either is they were written for a different audience. The purpose of Yadaya, and it's about 2,500 pages, six volumes currently, is that it presents Yah's prophetic testimony, the history of our universe and of humankind, past, present, and future. You see, prophecy with God isn't just about things that he wrote about in the past that have come to occur later or are on the cusp of occurring now, but it's all a continual timeline. All of human history, from the time that we were, the time the universe was formed, all the way to the time that Adam and Chawa were in the garden, to the time they were expelled from the garden for corrupting Yahweh's testimony in league with the adversary, to the time of the flood, to the time of Abraham, who we're studying now as we search the Word of God for insights on his covenant, through God's troubled relations with the Israelites, to Yahusha's fulfillment of the first four Mikra, to what he says is going to happen in our immediate future, what he said was going to happen that has happened in our immediate past. It's all a tapestry of history. And so Yada Yah was written to reveal that tapestry of human history from beginning to end, recognizing that once you understand that everything Yahweh said, from the moment he spoke about how he created the universe, the order of things, the means to those things, the purpose of those things, the hows and the why of what he referred to as the Big Bang, all the way through his return, that when you put all of that testimony before people who are open-minded, and I wrote it specifically for atheists and agnostics, those who are open-minded, those who valued evidence and reason. Because if you value evidence and reason, if you are rational, you'll come to read this material and you say, there is a 0% possibility that this was written by individual men over a 2,000-year period or 1,500-year period. None. That this was inspired by someone who knew history, past, present, and future, all the way back to the Big Bang, all the way forward to the end of the universe as we know it. It's the only rational conclusion that can be drawn from the evidence. So the only thing that separates an agnostic or an atheist from knowing God and understanding what he's offering is a willingness to invest the time to read what he has to say and apply reason to it. That's why Yada Yah was written. It appealed almost exclusively to atheists and agnostics, but not universally so. There are some Christians who migrated out of Christianity into agnosticism who embraced it. Now, that is not the case with An Introduction to God. An Introduction to God is an entirely different book written for an entirely different reason. It was written for those who are serious about getting to know what God had to say, what it means to us, understanding what his word represents, understanding how they can come to study their word. You know, the first volume of it provides the reader with a history of the manuscripts that are available to us, and a history, historical presentation of the Hebrew alphabet, what the letters represent, what the tools are that we can use to come to understand what these words mean, and then provides the reader with the ability to go off and do their own voyage of discovery, but then takes them through the seven topics that are the most important for us to know about Yahweh so that they can apply these tools that they have just learned to come to know who God is and what he's offering and how to capitalize on what he's offering. So the answer, Bill, is to invest your time. It's the most rewarding, most enjoyable thing you can do with your life and coming to know Yahweh's testimony better. He provides all the answers. And then once you find that you can get those that you love, those you care about, to be open-minded and question their religion, then what you have to share with them will resonate with them. Yahweh says not only is his Torah the means to restore human souls, but that it's easy to understand for those that are open-minded. That said, we have Joseph calling in from Ohio. Hello, Joseph.
How are you? How are you today, Yada?
Fine, thank you.
Hey, I have a little question for you today.
Okay.
I understand the nature of the program. You've exposed the corruption of political, religious, economic schemes, and the like.
Yes.
And in the process of that, you know, you'll cite different religions that are corrupt, such mm-hmm. as Islam, Catholicism, mm-hmm. Protestantism, you name it, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But there's one group I've never really heard you talk about on Shattering Myths before, and I'm not going to tell you who they are right off the bat. I'll just give you some clues and see if you know
okay.
who they are.
Okay.
Why I bring these guys into it is because there seems to be a lot of controversy about them, especially amongst religious people, and that, you know, some people view them as being just another branch of the Protestant religion. Others people view them as being a religious cult.
Okay, before you go on, and I want you to give you all the time in the world to present this, and I like the way you're sneaking up on it as opposed to just blurting it out. I really enjoy that kind of presentation.
Yes.
What is your view on religions? What the major religions? Christianity, Islam.
Well, unfortunately, Yada, like yourself, I think that the enemy can use any institution he wants. You know, to corrupt people, be it religious, economic, militaristic, or the like. So I think any institution, this is just my general worldview, any institution can be used to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't put any in a special category or anything like that, but that's my view.
Okay. Do you think that Islam, for example, offers answers that to who God is and what he wants and how to approach him?
Well... If they do, Yada, they're awfully skewed, let's put it that way.
Okay. How about Christianity?
Well, here's the thing with Christianity, and here's what I would say with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of groups, as I say, that, you know, go under the guise of Christianity and different mm-hmm. things like that. And so I think that I would just, you know, you said that you came out of a Christian background, as mm-hmm. did Bill. I would say that just approaching it from this perspective, I would say that being the fact that he was a Presbyterian or raised a Presbyterian.
Well, that was me, actually. I was raised a Presbyterian.
You were raised a Presbyterian. Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Yeah, I was an elder of the Presbyterian church.
Right. I guess being a Presbyterian, just because you're part of a church, doesn't mean, in my view, that you have a true relationship with God.
No, as a matter of fact, I can say for certain that the God that I thought I had a relationship with while I was active in the Presbyterian Church was a God that was manufactured by man. It wasn't the God who created man, but a God instead that was created by man. We'll return with Joseph, who is calling in from Ohio about a religion in just a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have a caller who was in the process of asking a question that they were leading up to and kind of sneaking up to, if you will. Caller's name is Joseph, calling in from Ohio, a marvelous state. And I interrupted just to kind of get a little feel for Joseph's own perspective. But now that we've done that, floor is yours, Joseph. Lead up to this religion that you think that I don't speak of quite often, and we'll address
it. Okay, thank you so much, Yada. Anyhow, the movement that I'm talking about,
mm-hmm.
why I bring these guys into it, as I pointed out prior to the break, that mm-hmm. there's a lot of controversy about them, you know, even amongst religious people, you know, are they a Protestant religion? Right. Are they a cult and different things like that? And what astounds me even more, Yada, is not just the fact that they've grown a lot. I don't know if it's because of their emphasis on prophecy or whatever, but the types of sects that have split off from them, such as, you know, the Jehovah's Witnesses, Herbert W. Armstrong, Branch Davidians, all that stuff. But the main nucleus that I'm talking about is based around the teachings of a lady by the name of Ellen G. White. And I, if I'm not mistaken, I think Paul Harvey used to quote her periodically on his Rest of the Story program. But
mm-hmm.
I think you know what group I'm talking about. And is that a group that you have discussed? And if not, how come?
Yeah, no, it isn't a group that I have discussed. I have I've discussed Jehovah's Witnesses because they come up periodically. I'm quite concerned about the Jehovah's Witnesses for, and you say they're a derivative, so I have spoken of them. And my concern about the Jehovah's Witnesses is that, A, if you're going to call yourself a witness of someone and you can't even get their name right, you certainly are not speaking on their behalf. And the second is the story that I tell of the counterfeit bill. Jehovah's Witnesses are right in the sense that they recognize that the Torah was inspired by God. They don't know God's name, and that therefore it cannot be discarded as mainstream Pauline Christianity dictates. And so they try to pay more attention to the Torah than does any other form of mainstream Christianity, but they don't want to reject Paul, and yet you can't accept the Torah and accept Paul. And so I view this as is the issue with a counterfeit bill. Are the Jehovah's Witnesses, should they have gotten Yahweh's name right, more credible or less credible? More beguiling or less beguiling because they try to embrace some of the Torah, which they don't understand, into their religion. And I view them as being more beguiling, not less so. And I would view the same thing with the Hebrew Roots Movement and the Messianic community. And that's because of the nature of a counterfeit bill. If I were to draw a counterfeit bill and use a pink Crayola and show bunny rabbits on it, I'm not going to fool anybody. But if I use a black-green pen and I draw it so that most of the lines match, while the bill that I have created is a counterfeit and absolutely worthless, I am much more likely to fool a lot more people. And so I look at these blending of Pauline doctrine and Torah religions like the Messianics, the Hebrew Roots Movement, and Jehovah's Witnesses as being far more damaging because their counterfeit is more susceptible to being accepted, and yet it's still a counterfeit.
But what about like the Seventh-day Adventists? Have you discussed this?
No, I haven't. Only for one reason, and that is that no one has brought up a question about them. But here's the issue with Seventh-day Adventists. If you look at, and I'll use the Jehovah's Witnesses as an example. Jehovah's Witness recognized that God does have a name. They just haven't been able to figure out what God's name is. That's a problem. The Seventh-day Adventists have recognized that there is absolutely no justification whatsoever for Sunday worship. That Sunday worship is purely pagan. It was instituted by Constantine and the Roman Catholic Church to honor the sun god. And it is absolutely pagan that every Christian that goes to a church on Sunday is emulating the Babylonian religion of old. And it has absolutely no justification. In fact, God says it is an abomination. So it is true that if you're going to emphasize this one aspect of Yahweh's teaching, that you should gather and discuss his testimony on the seventh day, on the Shabbat, that's the truth. It's certainly closer to the truth. But what if everything you say thereafter isn't true? Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Joseph, who has called in from Ohio. His question was, why have I not addressed the beliefs of the Seventh-day Adventist Church? And I admitted that I had not addressed the Seventh-day Adventist Church because no one had raised them as an individual institution to openly discuss. They're very seldom in the news. So unlike the Catholic Church, there isn't pedophilia cases to present or money laundering cases to present regarding them. But Joseph, I've done something. And I'm hopeful that not only can we spend the next 30 minutes of this program discussing the errors of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, but my hope is that you'll call in again in another program in not too distant future, because there are 28 statements that are made by the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and they call them fundamental beliefs. And they're all wrong, all of them. So what I'd like to do is, since you brought this up, are you game for going through them and discussing them?
Well, I'll let you do that. I'll let you discuss them, and I'll kind of
can you
comment.
Can you at least tell me why you? I think it's important to discuss them, because there's a lot of these people who have been misled by this group, and all 28 of their statements are erroneous.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that you are interested in the Seventh-day Adventist Church?
Well, I've never heard you talk about them, and I just thought I'd call and say, well, you know, I'll ask this guy how come he's never discussed them, because I know you've mentioned every other, you know, religious institution out there, and I thought, well, you know, I've never heard him mention them. I will say this, Yada, I'm sure,
sure.
You are aware that Adventists reject the mainline Christian view of hell. They believe in what's called annihilationism, I believe, where they believe, you know, the wicked are going to be burned up, and I'm sure you're also aware that they do not believe, well, they obviously, I think, believe in a resurrection, but
yes,
they don't believe in an immortal soul. I'm sure you're aware of that.
Yeah, so there are some things that are incorporated within their 28 beliefs that are accurate.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that each of the points collectively, when you, for example, to say that souls are annihilated is true, but to say there is no hell is untrue.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
so
they go to an extreme.
Right. So
yeah.
So if you a half truth is more dangerous than an outright lie. That's how in fact you were talking about how the adversary can use any institution to corrupt. That's the primary means that Hasatan, the adversary, uses to corrupt humankind, is half-truth. When he slithered into the garden, he did not tell Chawa an overt lie. He used a corruption of Yah's testimony and a half-truth to imply something that was unreliable. And half-truths are far more beguiling, far more destructive than outright lies. One of the things that always plagues me about to people when they think that if Christianity were inspired by Paul, who claimed to be demon-possessed, then it must be overtly satanic. And since it's not overtly satanic from their perspective, that it can't be inspired by the adversary. And you say, why is it that you would think that the adversary wants to be worshipped as Satan? He doesn't want to be worshipped as Satan. He doesn't want to be known as the adversary. He wants to be worshipped as God. So he's going to use half-truths to put himself in a position where he is considered God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, I'll tell you this, Yon. I know we're on the subject of Seventh-day Adventist.
Uh-huh.
It kind of ties in. I've actually run into on the radio some Yahweh teachers out there. I know you don't like the term teacher, but I'm just going to use
yes.
it.
Yes.
That will say they're believers in Yahweh, but they'll still identify themselves as Oneness Apostolic Pentecostals. And then there's other ones that I've run into.
By the way, there are lots of skinheads, radical, crazy people around the world who call themselves, they usually use Yahweh, but they call themselves Yahwehists, and they're absolute nutcases. I mean, they're complete anarchists. They can say the name, but they have got absolutely no idea who he is. And, you know, my guess is there's a lot of people that have come to recognize that Hebrew is an extremely easy language to pronounce. There's 22 letters, five of which are vowels. And it took me one really focused day to prove conclusively that it is Yahweh. And so, you know, I'm not surprised that other people can do that, but that doesn't mean that you actually know who he is and understand what he's saying.
Well, I'll tell you this.
Yes.
I actually contacted personally. It's called Yahweh's Assemblies in Yahshua out of Michigan. They believe that means Yah saves in their view. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yahshua. So it's just so that we're communicating, and you are very articulate individual. You're also well-read and well-studied, so I hope you call in many more times. The reason you said they think that Yeshua means Yahweh saves is that there is a very well-distributed myth that that Shua is the Hebrew word for salvation. It isn't. It's a Hebrew word for cry out. Yeshua is actually used twice in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and it means Yahweh cries out. Yahosha is from the Hebrew verb Yasha, which is the Hebrew verb to save. And so Yahosha means Yahweh saves. It's used 220 times in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. So
right.
That's kind of the background. You obviously understood that, but I'm sure there's listeners that didn't.
Right. Well, and I asked them point blank. Mm-hmm. And by the way, this was not, I want to make this clear, it was not a church, okay? I want to make that real clear. It was, at least they claimed to be a Yahweh.
Right, good. And church is a pagan term.
If it was, I asked them personally, I said, is it typical? Because, see, I've heard this, you know, Yahweh name before, you know, this whole people like yourself. You are, however, I'll admit, the first guy on the radio I've ever heard call Shaul a false prophet.
Yes.
Whereas this group was telling me, you know, because I asked them, I said, is it typical for, you know, people like, you know, in the Yahweh, there's a term I'm trying to avoid, Yada, to call Shaul a false prophet, and they said, no, it's not, you know what I'm saying? So what I'm wondering is, based on the understanding that you have come to, which from what I understand was in 2008, was it, that you came to the understanding that Shaul was a false prophet?
Probably 5 or 6 years ago, so around that period of time.
Yes, if you don't mind my asking.
Sure.
Because of that, are there other professed, shall I say, Yahweh people out there that would denounce you because of this?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, the way that I came to know that Paul, the author of half the Christian New Testament, was a false prophet, is that a longtime friend, and most of the people I'm talking about here, I have only met through internet communications. But this individual, he's changed his name from David to Doad, so you get the actual pronunciation, lives in New Zealand. And he was listening to a Christian radio show that was saying that Paul said that the Torah had been annulled and that the Torah had no capability of saving anyone. And so he wrote me a letter and said, this is what the Christian radio station was claiming, that the Torah had been annulled and it was incapable of saving anyone. And they quoted from the third chapter of Paul's letter to the Galatians. So it is did they misquote Paul? Is the statement mistranslated or is it misinterpreted? What is the case here? And so this happened to be an extraordinarily thoughtful individual, a man who I've really come to, you know, if you can have brotherly love for another individual, this is a guy I really love. And I said, you know, I will promise you that I will do everything that I possibly can to be able to answer that question correctly.
Yeah.
And so I began studying Galatians, and I realized that Galatians was the first letter that Paul wrote. And I began to compare what he said in Galatians to what was said about the Jerusalem summit. The Jerusalem summit was the reason that Paul wrote Galatians as a rebuttal to the Jerusalem summit. And the Jerusalem summit is presented by Luke, who was not an attendee, but was a historian, and he presents it in the book of Acts. And I began to compare the two and said, wow, these are completely different accounts. And then I began to compare Paul's quotations of the Torah and prophets and found that every time that Paul quotes the Torah and prophets, he misquotes God. He not only takes the statement out of context, but his quotation of it is errant. And then he takes that out of context and twisted presentation to draw a conclusion that's the opposite of what God was actually saying within the context of the statement that he made in the Torah and prophets. And I became more and more troubled. And then I got to the point where Paul said that there are two covenants and that the one that's memorialized on Mount Sinai was made with Hagar and that it enslaves. I said, wait, that's the opposite of what's true. And then I must have gone to 200 Christian sites to say, how do Christians resolve this? Because what Paul said is blatantly untrue.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't. they say Paul's right, God's wrong.
Well, yeah, right. I understand we were on the Adventist study. We kind of went off on a little thing here.
But that's how I came to do that. And I spent the first time through, I spent 9 months, 6 days a week, 12 hours a day reading and studying the oldest manuscripts of Paul's letter to the Galatians and Paul's other letters. And I compared them to what Yahweh actually said or what Yahusha actually said. And I had to deal with the reality that there is no way to actually be aware of the difference between what Paul said and what Yahweh said and to believe Paul. It's impossible. You cannot be informed and rational and believe Paul if you are aware of what he said and how it conflicts with what Yahweh said. And so that's the reason I wrote Questioning Paul, was to expose him.
Well, let me ask you this, Yada.
Sure.
You know, obviously there were groups in the 30s that came into the truth of Yahweh, you know. And
yes, there were.
Let me ask you this. If men like Clarence Oddod, Jacob Ohmeyer, and others were alive today, and they could hear shattering myths, you know, and hear the teaching on Paul, would they be receptive to it, or do you think they'd be quick to denounce you as a total lunatic?
No, I think they'd be receptive. Thus far, I've had thousands of people from around the world, maybe even tens of thousands, that have read both the old version and the updated version of Questioning Paul. No one has read all of Questioning Paul who has come out a Christian. Every single one of them has denounced Paul. Welcome back to the concluding segment of Shattering Myths for today. We've had a very intriguing day in terms of our calls, but nothing more intriguing than Joseph's call from Ohio, which really began on why don't you do an expose on the Seventh-day Adventists, which I'm not going to be able to do today, but I promise I will do, because Joseph, before we get back to the detour on Paul, the reason that I have not spoken about the Seventh-day Adventists is they represent about one half of 1% of Christians. So they claim to be 20 million strong. My guess is that they're less than that. But at 20 million strong, they would be, you know, approximately one half of 1% of Christians. And so to specifically address them when they represent so few people, I know 20 million is a lot of people, but it's not in the greater scope of the things as the events of the world, it wouldn't naturally be a focus. However, as I have read through their position on their 28 statements, because almost all of their statements embody what's wrong with Christianity in general, I think that going through their 28 statements of belief is extraordinarily productive, because it doesn't apply just to one half of 1% of Christians, but there's parts of it that, in fact, huge swaths that apply to every Christian, and will be a nice foil to use to explain the difference between Christianity and Yahweh.
Well, what's interesting, Yada, you know, I was going to say this before I go here.
Yes.
I did come across a broadcast. Remember I told you earlier I've come across some other Yahweh people out there? There was a guy that I came across on the radio, and he was talking about, you know, the one and only true name for God being Yahweh and all of this stuff. And what he did was he then called the Messiah, as we discussed, Yahshua instead of Yahusha.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
But
right.
Then he took it a step further and said, not only should you not call God by any other name except Yahweh, you know, such as, you know, Adonai, Allah, Jesus,
right.
You name it.
Right.
But you shouldn't even call him God, because that in and of itself is the term of a Babylonian, an ancient Babylonian astrological.
And that is not true. That's a title.
Yeah,
it's
that's
not
that's,
true.
Yeah, that's
that,
Larry,
that
actually.
True.
That's just come in.
Researched it.
Yeah.
Can I throw something in here just real quick?
And Joseph, please call back. I really enjoy having you on the program, and I do want you to participate in our review of this particular topic. But,
what I was going to do, Giada, is I was going to give you this guy's website, if you like.
No. You gave me the project to denounce the Seventh-day Adventists and all of Christianity because of their statements is a worthy project, and it's going to take a fair amount of time. I'm not going to research it. I'm just going to simply read their statement and respond to it as we go through it. But it's a big enough project in and of itself. What Larry was going to say on the use of God, and I get, I must have gotten 1,000 letters on this. God himself uses El and Elohim as his title and to denounce false gods. And it is nothing but a title. It is not a name. And so titles are words that if we're going to convey, we have to translate out of one language into another language. Names you transliterate. I'm sure you know these things, Joseph, that a name like Yahweh, you need to transliterate, which means you replicate its sound using the letters and the speech of a different language. So Yahweh is Yahweh in every language. But El and Elohim, and Yahweh uses Elohim from Eloah, it's the plural of El, a derivative of Eloah, throughout his Torah, prophets, and Psalms as not only his title, but he says that there are false Elohim. And so because it's a word and used as a word, we need to translate it so we understand what the word means. And the word is a combination of two Hebrew letters, one being the Aleph, which is shown as the ram's head. It symbolizes the power and authority of the lamb to accomplish all that needs to be done. It's always used in conjunction with father, for example, begins with the same term. And then it's the lamed in Hebrew, which is the staff, and it talks about a shepherd and the role of a shepherd to lead his sheep. And so it's God's influence in our lives. His title describes the role that he can play in shepherding, which is to care for, to nurture, to protect his sheep. But El and Elohim are words. They're used as a title, not a name, and we ought not be fixated on them.